Welcome to College Land, the podcast featuring untold stories from higher education. I'm Nan Enstead in Madison, Wisconsin.
I'm Lisa Levenstein in Greensboro, North Carolina. We're here to explore life inside our nation's colleges and universities and to track some of the major changes that are happening. Today on our show, we'll share an interview about university presses, the institutions on college campuses that publish scholarly books, academic journals, and more.
But first, listeners, if you have an idea for a show, we'd like to hear from you. Please contact us by email at collegelandpod@gmail.com, by Facebook or Twitter at collegelandpod. So first, a segment we're calling This Week on Campus.
And Nan, this week on campus, what was really standing out to me was the work speed up that we've all been experiencing. In March, when we went home because of the pandemic, we assumed that the intensity of transferring our courses and administrative duties online would eventually let up. And I feel like we all went into overdrive to make the pivot. But now, like, we're a year in, and I'm not feeling like that sense of overdrive has lessened.
Yeah, I am also feeling it, Lisa. I'm really grateful to have a job. I just want to get that out on the table. And it's one that allows me to work at home during the pandemic. So thank you for that, universe. I do not take that for granted. But there are a bunch of things that have conspired to make both teaching and learning more of a crush than in the typical semester. And it feels like a serious thing to me. Like at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our administrators made the decision to cancel spring break. And our faculty senate approved it. And, you know, that made sense. It made sense to cancel spring break. It's a move to prevent students, staff, and faculty across the country from traveling and spreading COVID-19, and a lot of universities did it. But, you know, in so many places, like my university, it was replaced with basically nothing. So there's 14 solid weeks of classes. There is one day off, but I just even found out that there is one day off in our calendar because they never put it onto the online calendar. A student had to tell me. So this has really created mental health issues for our students especially, and I'm worried about them. Do you have a spring break at UNC Greensboro, Lisa?
We had one health and wellness day, which was on a Wednesday in the middle of the week, so no one would go anywhere. And we didn't have classes that day, but emails that needed immediate attention kept pouring in, as they continue to do on weekends and at all hours of the night. You know, I heard someone speaking the other day. They said that what used to be a phone call is now an email. And I think also what I'm seeing is that what used to be an email is now a Zoom meeting. It seems like my calendar is filled to the brim with various kinds of meetings that are all now happening on Zoom, none of which would have happened before the pandemic. People would have, you know, settled it with an email or a quick phone call, but now we're all required to meet. It seems there's kind of very little excuse not to show up at a Zoom meeting because people know we're at home. And as you say, you know, thankfully I can teach at home. Thankfully I have a job and I'm working from home, but it has created a kind of relentless pace of going from one meeting to another. I have like multiple alarms on my phone right now that tell me when I need to be logging on to be at a Zoom meeting. And I'm not getting the kind of, you know, we're not getting the fresh air that we usually get when we even walk from one building to another. So I think it's feeling like things, if anything, are just kind of continuing to speed up. Nothing has at all toned down. And in fact, my calendars, and I think everyone's calendar, including our students, probably most particularly our students, are just getting more and more filled. And it is something that I think is a cause for concern, particularly when we look at the mental health issues that are facing so many students and also professors and staff.
Yeah, sometimes I find myself just craving reading a book.
Well, that's a perfect lead-in, Nan, to our interview, which I'm excited to share. It's an interview with John Scherer, who's the director of the University of North Carolina Press. And, you know, university presses are really important parts of universities that I never really thought that much about until I became an author, quite honestly. But eventually, I became such a fan that I joined the editorial board of UNC Press.
Yeah, Lisa, we really share that commitment. I just became part of the board of the University of Wisconsin Press in 2020. And one reason I did is because university presses are often publishing really different stuff than for-profit presses. So University of Wisconsin Press, for example, was a leader in publishing gay and lesbian memoir at a time when major presses were not interested. And, you know, they also publish academic journals and poetry and scholarly research that's important to the production of art and knowledge, but isn't going to make a profit.
University presses are really integral to what universities do, but at a time of budget cuts, rolling crises in the world of publishing in general, it's sometimes kind of a rocky ride. So let's listen to John Shearer talk about that. More than 100 North American universities have a university press on their campus. These university presses are driven by a different set of priorities than what are known as trade presses, and those are presses like Penguin or Random House. Penguin's goal is to sell as many books as possible. University presses also want to sell as many books as they can, but when they decide whether or not to publish a particular book, they aren't just looking at potential profits. In fact, many books they publish don't turn a profit at all, and that's okay. It's something that they accept as par for the course. Rather than hunt only for the big money makers, university presses are looking to publish titles that will advance new knowledge and change how people think about the world. They publish books that people working in academia will want to read and want to assign to their students. They publish books that they believe will make our world better. A few of these titles might sell tens of thousands of copies, but university presses also make room to publish books that they know will have a limited audience, but are making important contributions to our world. It's a fascinating field, and we're fortunate to have with us today someone who knows it very well, the director of the University of North Carolina Press, John Shearer, and he's going to talk with us about how publishing has changed in the past few decades and what that means for university presses. John Shearer, welcome to College Land.
Thank you, Lisa. That was a wonderful introduction. It's a delight to be here.
A few years ago, it seemed like everyone was talking about the end of the book. Kindle and Amazon were thriving, and it seemed like the digital revolution might make print totally obsolete, really. Can you take us back to that moment? When was it, and what it was like to be a publisher then?
Certainly. It was an interesting time, and we're in an interesting time now for sure. But you have to remember 2007, 2008 is when the first Kindle device was launched. And this is at the same time as the Great Recession is in full swing. And so we're looking around in the book business and we're thinking we're going to become the music business. We're thinking bookstores are going to close. Everybody's going to start downloading material. These devices are going to proliferate. And for a while, we're actually kind of happy with it because there's some good things about economically about ebooks. There are no returns. It's pretty high margin. You don't have to print, warehouse, and all of those sorts of things. But then a very odd thing happens, which is it turns out people really like reading physical books. And that's happened in the commercial world where, you know, even in trade publishing, you know, 70% of the business is print. And it's certainly true in academic publishing where people do what I like to call immersive reading. And we found that even though people do a lot of discovery in digital formats, engagement still seems to really happen in print. And at UNC Press, 85% of our revenue is still print-based.
What do you think that's about? What drives that? Why do people still want to buy actual books?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I hear every argument from it's a generational thing and that, you know, the next decade that may all change to, you know, we publish a lot of history and that historians are Luddites and, you know, there's lots of different things for it. But there's also some really interesting research going on that shows that for it, that as I described kind of immersive reading, it's done more effectively on a stable page. The ephemeral quality of digital devices, kind of the retention isn't as good. A lot of humanists like to annotate. There's also people who just at 2 o'clock in the morning when you feel the inspiration to do research, you want to know that that book is right there on your shelf and you can just grab it and pick it up right where you were. There's a great, you know, people are saturated with, you know, computers all day long. And so I think there's a sense of moving out of the interface where you can be distracted by the other affordances of these devices and moving into something where you're doing a singular activity of engagement is a very powerful thing. So I think there's a bunch of things going on that frankly transcend, you know, generational divides.
I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit more now about what makes a university press unique. And I'm thinking that maybe we can delve into that by you describing what happens when an author sends a manuscript to UNC Press and asks if you would be interested in publishing it. So what kinds of factors do your editors consider, and how much do potential sales enter into those decisions?
So, you know, we like to think of ourselves as operating within a pretty broad landscape of university presses. As you mentioned, there's over 100, even just in North America. So we're not here to publish everybody's book. We want to have kind of a silo of expertise in certain disciplines. And some are very obvious, probably, to your listeners. We're a great history publisher. We publish a lot about the American South and religion. And so we are looking for manuscripts in the fields where we're already strong in publishing. We are, frankly, this doesn't sound fun to say, but we're in the business of rejection. We say no to lots of terrific manuscripts that will be published in other places, partly because they're not in the right field for us, or we've just published a similar book on a similar topic, or we have somebody working on something similar. But the fundamental thing that we do is the peer review process. So every manuscript that comes in and is going to be seriously considered is sent out to two blind reviewers. Two reviewers who are blind to the author, and they're assessed for, you know, whether they are kind of, we like to say, kind of like worthy of one of the very limited slots that we have at UNC Press. And so we get that process happens, and then our editor, acquiring editor, kind of makes an assessment as well. And, you know, sometimes we'll see a lot of peer review reports that suggest this is fine scholarship, but is it actually advancing the field as much as other projects are, and maybe not. So the peer review process is, you know, I came from commercial publishing. It's a thing that's fundamentally different from really the rest of any other kind of publishing is peer review. There are archaic qualities to it. And of course it's a human intervention, so it is necessarily highly flawed. And yet almost every case I see of peer review, it inevitably enhances the scholarship in a book, and it certainly helps us to make sure that we're publishing books that are on the cutting edge of the fields that we're publishing in.
So it seems like what you're saying is that when you get a manuscript, you're sending it out to two experts in the field who don't know who wrote this manuscript, and they're assessing it in terms of the quality of the scholarship, not how many people are going to buy it, but is this the highest quality scholarship, something that's really saying something new, that's going to bring something new to the field of history or whatever field it's in. And that is the way that you make a decision about whether to give one of those treasured slots to that book.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Lisa. There's actually a kind of a tension between what a lot of the peer reviewers want to see included in the book. Sometimes it'll be, you know, more primary research, or it's under theorized, and it's funny because I know our marketing people read those peer review reports. They're like, no, please, like no more primary research. Let's keep this book tight and argument driven. And so there's almost a tension between what makes great scholarship versus what can be sold the most of. Now, every once in a while, we're able to kind of thread the needle and do a little bit of both. But our business model is not contingent on us selling, you know, thousands and thousands of copies of every book we publish. We want to make sure that we're engaged with the networks of kind of leading scholars in the discipline that we publish in. And so we don't have to sell 5,000 copies of every book that we publish. And in fact, we're probably doing it wrong if we do, because we're helping the leading scholars in the field to help them push their thinking as well. And so it is not uncommon for us to have print runs in the 400 to 600 to 800 copy range. And we do that without any sense of failure. Like that is the model that we have chosen, and that is what we do.
And that's a business model that you've managed to make work somehow? Like, how does that all work out, and what does the ledger sheet look like in terms of this?
Yeah, it takes some creativity and some non-traditional things. We've done the math, and we think we are able to lose as much as $15,000 to $20,000 for every monograph that we publish. And so how do you do that? Well, we get very generous support from the university, from the state of North Carolina. We do a lot of fundraising. We have a pretty significant endowment, which we've been working on for, you know, more than four decades. And so, yes, you need these ancillary income streams in order to support a robust monograph program. And so, yeah, we're looking for other ways to support the prime mission of publishing the scholarship, but you have to find other channels. The other one that I should have mentioned kind of up front is we do publish some regional trade books. So, you know, one of our best-selling books last year was a Mushroom Guide to North Carolina. So you might think, why is a university press publishing a mushroom guide? But it's generated almost six figures of income for the press, and that helps support a lot of monographs.
During the Black Lives Matter protests over the summer, many activists started recommending stacks of books for people looking to educate themselves on racial issues. And UNC Press has been a leader in publishing books on Black and Indigenous history, social movement, Southern culture, and white supremacy. And so as a result, many of those stacks of books included UNC Press titles. And during the protests, I think maybe the press may have also made a decision to make some of your books freely available to the public. Can you talk about that moment and what it meant for the press to have so many of your titles being talked about on the public stage?
Yeah, it was a moment of enormous pride for us and a sense of validation almost, because you know, a lot of these books we had published at these, you know, five-figure losses that I was describing before, and then suddenly this summer we couldn't print them fast enough. Lisa, I've been in the book business for more than three decades, and I've never seen anything like what happened this summer, which is the fact that, I mean, clearly there was a social movement that felt, you know, slightly unprecedented, although maybe not without any precedent. But the scholarship and the people who were studying this and writing about it were embraced by people in the movement. And actually, because we were all stuck at home, like one of the things that you could do was sit and read other people's books and amplify them. And so we were literally printing some of these books as fast as we could. So at the same time, you're right, we made a decision to open up our scholarship in its digital forms. That actually was more tied to the pandemic, where a lot of students, you know, had to sprint out of the, you know, their campuses in the middle of the spring semester and literally like leaving their textbooks in their dorm rooms, no access to the library, no IP connection to be able to read digital editions. And so some of our library partners came to us and said, look, the students are really struggling and can you do something? And back in March and April, we thought we were in real trouble financially, but we just said, this, you know, a moment of crisis is actually when you show your values. So we did. We made a commitment to open up, you know, thousands of academic monographs, make them, you know, what we call open access for a period of time. And we saw exponential increases in their usage. It was a fascinating experiment. As I'd like to say, we had to reset the perimeters to the bar chart of usage because it went so high. And there was some risk in it because we would normally charge for that type of usage. On the other hand, it was this validation of, boy, if you make this scholarship available, people really are desperate to read it. And so it's been more than just sort of, oh, we felt good about helping, doing our part during this social crisis and during this health crisis. We may have learned something about the high demand for our books when you make them open.
Now, of course, the story isn't all rosy in terms of Black Lives Matter and UNC Press and the university press and the publishing world in general. During Black Lives Matter, like so many other institutions in our culture, the world of publishing looked within and thought more deeply about its own complicity with racism and inequality. Can you tell us a little bit about that reckoning and how it played out at UNC Press?
Yeah, I'm really glad you raised this, Lisa. And I will say up front, I am a white man in his 50s named John. And so I am, you know, part of the legacy problem here. I think publishing, well, there's several issues here. On the one hand, publishing in general has been a relatively progressive business. We publish books about progressive topics. And I think there's been a sense that that's an inoculation against having to do more, about doing the hard kind of inward looking. There's also, you don't go to publishing school. And so you have to get that first job in publishing and learn how publishing works. And that first job in publishing for decades has meant you're going to have a salary between $25,000 and $30,000, which means you better have an alternative source of income as well. And so there are these reinforcing mechanisms that has just caused us to keep hiring people that look like ourselves and had our own kind of similar backgrounds, which is, you know, a natural human thing, but it becomes toxic when it's kind of paired with this kind of inoculation that I talked about before, like, oh, well, if we publish books on race, then we don't actually have to worry about how we look. And it's a real challenge. It is a fundamental inequality that we have in publishing. I would say our author pool is really quite diverse, and I would be, you know, kind of stack that up against what anybody's doing. But when I look at the staff around the table, it's not where it needs to be. We've made real progress in the last 3 years, but we are at the beginning of a very long kind of race here, or hike, or whatever you want to call it, whatever the right metaphor is. This is something, it's described as something that is kind of permanently ongoing, but we are really just at the first steps. We're starting to map the demographics of our staff against the demographics of the state of North Carolina, and it's just, they're terrible. Like, we need to do much better.
I'd like to return to what you were talking earlier about open access and what you learned during the pandemic. Open access being, well, you can describe it better than I can, at least, but my understanding of it is making scholarly research and sometimes entire books freely available to the public with no restrictions or paywalls. And so could you tell us a little bit about why university presses would consider making their books available through open access and what that process would entail? Because I know that, you know, big money making clearly isn't your main goal, but you need to make some, right? So why are you considering giving books away for free when it's not the pandemic? Why is this kind of a trend that's happening? These conversations seem to be happening, and these were happening before the pandemic, and it seems that they're going to probably be continuing afterwards.
Yeah. How can we take a business model where we lose $15,000 a book and make it even worse by giving away the digital, right? So what are we doing here? So open access means different things in different environments. To be clear, in scientific journal publishing, it means something quite different than it does in humanities monograph publishing. So I'm limiting my comments to humanities monograph publishing here. But essentially the idea is that instead of doing what we call a cost recovery model, that you have kind of a pre-funded model. So it costs money to publish a book, somewhere between $20,000 and $40,000, depending on, you know, the complexity of the book. Somebody has to pay for that. And historically, we have charged people for access to the formats. And that's how we, that's the business model, cost recovery. Sell enough copies, you can keep going forward and publish more books. So the concept with open access is, if you had a little bit of funding up front, could you remove the transactional model on the back end? I think this is limited to the digital space. Nobody's talking about printing books and giving physical books away for free. What's interesting here is that there's some evidence, and I was alluding to this earlier, that even when you give away the digital, that you actually create potential print customers. In fact, you may be creating print customers that you never would have had if you had delimited access to the digital edition. So there's this kind of irony that by giving away the digital, you may actually convert somebody into a print customer who never would have discovered in the first place. So that's a potentially a very powerful tool. Open access goes from kind of an economic threat to almost like a marketing tool. It becomes digital becomes about discoverability instead of cannibalization. The other thing, and I'll circle back to the topic we were just talking about social justice and equity. One of the activities that we do at the press is we try to look at everything that we do through a lens of equity and justice. And so you can talk about hiring, you can talk about the types of books you want to publish, but we also have to talk about our business model. We have an inherently elitist business model. We are very good. We are excellent at putting books into elite institutions. Like, our business model is set up for that. But if you're trying to reach the majority of the world, we're kind of poor at that. It is a very inequitable business model and distribution model. So what open access does is it suddenly says, like, you don't have to be a scholar who is relatively privileged at an elite institution to have access to our books, or you don't have to have a credit card where you can drop $45 whenever you feel like you need a new book on it. Like I said, we're good at those models. Those are easy. What's hard is when you publish a book about the history of Sufism in North Africa, can you have people in North Africa read that book? And open access then suddenly becomes a tool, in fact, the tool, the singular tool, that where you go from almost, you know, a complete inability to distribute physical books, much less to have people there to buy them, to making it available to anybody who has a stable internet portal.
Where are we at in terms of a move towards open access? Are a lot of university presses considering doing this? Are other kinds of presses considering it? Where are we at? Are people doing it already? I mean, where are, in terms of books about history or literature, not, I mean, I understand that science is its own field, but where are we at in this process? And do you really think that this is the future?
You know, I think it's the future for a type of book. So to be clear, I'm not suggesting that we just completely toss our existing models and replace it with this. But certainly for, you know, a specialized monograph where our intention was to try and print and sell 400 copies, you know, it could be that OA is a better, a more effective, even financially more effective business model. It's certainly a better distribution model. We're in a stage of experimentation and, frankly, great caution. It is hard to run a university press. And as I was kind of, I was being glib before, but the idea of like presenting a new tool that lets you earn even less income up front is not something that a lot of university press directors get excited about. there is, you know, there's some prejudice on the assumption that if a book can't sell enough copies, it's not worthy scholarship. So this kind of, this debate that goes on, you know, in presses, but I think in the academy as well, which is, you know, to what degree is public engagement, you know, more valid than kind of peer-to-peer engagement. So, you know, we're wrestling with all of that. There's a lot of experimentation going on. There's a program called Knowledge Unlatched and Tour to Open Monograph Ecosystem. And at UNC Press, we're leading a pilot called the Sustainable History Monograph Pilot, which is working with about 22 university presses to try and publish around 100 history monographs, open access. So there's it's a really very enjoyable era of kind of experimentation. And so we're trying to learn a couple of things through this. So how will these books be perceived? Will they get reviewed? Will they win awards? Will they help, you know, junior scholars get tenure? What happens to the print activity? Do print books, you know, sell? Do they stop selling? And, you know, how does it, you actually have, the workflows are kind of different when you publish open access. The metadata has to be a little more robust. We have to distribute it into open platforms that we don't normally do. So there's new pipe and infrastructure and capacity building that we have to do. So I would say it's kind of early stages. It's really interesting time. But the validation of, you know, I alluded to earlier, when we kind of crashed all of our books open over the summer and we saw this exponential increase in usage, I think what's going to happen is we're going to start seeing usage for these books at levels that just are incomparable to the traditional print model. So, you know, like I said, our goal sometimes is to sell 400 or 500 copies of a print book. We're getting these usage reports of tens of thousands of downloads in these kind of geographical patterns that just look so different than what we've historically done. So my belief is that over time, we will see that OA for a type of monograph publishing is not just better. It's actually far superior, clearly a better way to do it. And so that's my assumption, is that's what we're going to get. We're still in the data gathering stage, though, right now.
Are there other things that you would most want our listeners to know about university presses and their role in higher education and our culture at large? What do you want people to take away from this conversation?
You know, it's funny, when I talk to people about publishing, people know publishing exists, but they don't really think of publishers, and that's okay. You know, nobody walks into a bookstore and says, you know, what do you have from Simon and Schuster? Like that's not how publishing works. But I do think, you know, in an era where, you know, the fake news era, and where there's, you know, you can read anything that you want to find on the internet, you know, taking a second to look on the spine of the book that you're considering, or, you know, you read a review and you see who it is, thinking about the process, the peer review process I was talking about before, the intensive copy edit and proofreading that university presses do. You know, the most valuable commodity for your listeners is their time. And so are you going to spend 15 hours with something of kind of dubious quality and be, you know, very frustrated at having kind of potentially wasted that time? And so I guess one of the messages I've been trying to do is, you know, go see who the publisher is. And if it's University Press, you should probably feel pretty good that time is going to be very well invested.
John Shearer, thank you for spending time today with College Land.
It's been a delight. Thank you for having me, Lisa.
Well, Nan, as you can see, John Shearer is a pretty convincing advocate for university presses as well as for open access. You know, honestly, when I first learned about open access, I was pretty vehemently opposed to it. I really assumed it was going to bring financial disaster to university presses and couldn't imagine authors agreeing to let their books be freely available to anyone who wanted to read them, essentially without any costs. I mean, how did this strike you when you first heard about it?
Well, I'm emotionally attached to the book as a format for a lot of the reasons that John mentioned. So I'm always so happy when I can close my computer and pick up a book to read. So open access just bothered me, mostly because I was afraid books were going to go away altogether. But when the pandemic hit and I couldn't go to the library, I did access tons and tons of stuff that was newly available on open access. And I was starting a new project. And so it was great. I'm a convert. And then John is right. I ended up buying a bunch of the physical books that I accessed online first because, you know, I want to read the books in person.
I am so glad to hear that you bought those books because university presses really need our support right now. You know, kudos to UNC Press for their remarkable year, but even they are predicting that there could be really tough times ahead. We've talked on College Land about the budget cuts being implemented by many public universities in the wake of the pandemic, and some of those cuts are pretty likely to trickle down to their presses.
Yeah, we have been following that the University of Kansas Press has been struggling as the whole university is with major threatened cuts. And we just learned that the dean of the library is going to step in as the director of the Press of Kansas. So that keeps it from closing for now. But other presses besides UNC have been doing well this year because people were buying so many more books. So UW Press had a pretty good year despite the pandemic. And I was talking to the director of UW Press, Dennis Lloyd, about, you know, the support for smaller presses that don't compete with for-profit publishers like UNC does. And really, UNC Press is in the category of doing the most sales, the most revenue a year. But most university presses are in a category of doing relatively low volume of sales. They just operate altogether on a smaller scale model. And Dennis Lloyd said that, you know, it really depends on a university administration recognizing the value of having a press, that there are both tangible and intangible values. A press can bring attention and prestige and authority to a university and its researchers. And at a press like UW Press, there's fewer staff, but they do more things. And the upside is that there's a potential for experimentation. Small university presses are often leading the way in publishing in new fields. So, you know, here in College Land, one of our themes is thinking about how universities are connected to the wider public and to the public good. And university presses are really part of creating new kinds of knowledge, new kinds of research, new kinds of art that goes beyond a for-profit model.
And so now let's dig down into some specifics with our letter of recommendation, in which we find some very cool things in the world to recommend to you. And today it's going to be books by university presses. I'm going to follow up on what John said about all of the UNC Press books that were on Black Lives Matter reading lists, because I noticed that one of my favorite books wasn't on many of the lists. It's called Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement and was published by UNC Press in 2003. And the author, Barbara Ransby, is just such an amazing historian and activist and also an absolutely gorgeous writer. And I love biographies in general, but this one is particularly inspiring. You know, Ella Baker was one of those unsung heroes of the 1960s civil rights movement, someone most people haven't heard that much about because she believed that her role was to empower other people to be leaders in their own right, not to take the spotlight. And so I think this book really teaches us about how radical social change can often happen in ways that go unnoticed. And it's really just a beautiful and inspiring read.
That sounds really cool. In fact, I know it's really cool because I've read it. It's a great book. So I was thinking about university presses, and I right away thought of the University of Oklahoma Press, because that press is really for decades been a go-to press for Native American studies. And so it fits into that category of paving the way in a field, and it is still a place that I go. So a book that I absolutely adore is called Indigenous Food Sovereignty in the United States, Restoring Cultural Knowledge, Protecting Environments, and Regaining Health. And it's an edited collection edited by Devon Masua and Elizabeth Hoover. And it's a really deep book. It's a collection, but I keep finding new things in that book all the time. But I am going to be a little bit piggy. And also I want to talk about the University of Texas Press, because University of Texas has long been a leader in Latinx studies, in Chicano, Chicana studies, border studies, inter-American studies. And those are all different categories for University of Texas Press. And a lot of other presses you go and they've just kind of got one Latinx category that they throw a lot of stuff into. And I think that really demonstrates their commitment at University University of Texas Press to exploring the nature of Latinx life in the United States and their unique geographic location on the border. So the book I wanted to mention that they've just published is by Francisco Galarte, and it's called Brown Transfigurations, Rethinking Race, Gender, and Sexuality in Chicanx and Latinx Studies. And this is one of the first books to focus solely on the trans Latinx experience. And then finally, I would be in big trouble with UW Press if I didn't mention a book from them. They publish a lot of poetry and fiction that just allows different kinds of voices to come to the fore than would come to the fore at another kind of press. And they have a poetry prize. A book that they published of poetry is called The Poetry of Capital, Voices from the 21st Century. And this is a collection of poetry edited by Benjamin Grossberg and Claire Rossini. And it's all kinds of poetry about money and capitalism.
I love that we're talking about the fact that university presses don't just publish academic books. You know, remember John mentioned UNC Press's popular Mushroom Guide. They also publish a series of food books called Savor the South. And each of the books in this series focuses on a particular ingredient that is like a mainstay of Southern cuisine. So there's rice and pecans and peaches, and one on catfish, one on corn. You know, my favorite one, I think, is the one on sweet potatoes, which is something actually I rarely cooked with before I moved to North Carolina. And now it's like pretty much a mainstay of my cooking. And each of the books is like kind of has like a brief history of the ingredient and kind of interesting tidbits about their cultural importance. And then there's tons of really cool recipes like sweet potato muffins, sweet potato soup, sweet potato hummus, and of course, sweet potato pie.
Well, that's it for today from College Land. Remember, we want to hear from you. So if you have ideas for stories or questions, our email is collegelandpod@gmail.com. You can also reach us on Facebook or Twitter at @collegelandpod. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review on your favorite podcast app.
Thanks to our producer, the wonderful Rochelle Wilson, and to Wisconsin Humanities for their support.
Thanks for visiting College Land.